Hello and welcome to Connected, episode 84. Connected this week is brought to you by our friends at Smile and Ministry of Supply. My name is Stephen Hackett, and I am joined this week by Mr. Federico Vitici.
Hello, Stephen.
Hey, buddy.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today?
I'm doing great, but we're missing, again, a piece. Mike is not here today.
Mike had a little time off, but he will be back next week.
The truth is, Mike actually went to Romania, but he didn't know how to come back. So we're not sure when Mike will be back, if he will be back, but we have a show to do, Stephen.
The show must go on, as they say.
Yes, even without Mike, is the asterisk on the Queen song, actually. But, you know.
And our show starts with follow-up. So we are going to jump right in. We got a lot of feedback about our comments last week concerning the 9.7-inch iPad Pro and the feeling that maybe somehow, as the three of us own 12.9-inch iPad Pros, that we were upset that Apple had put some new things in this new smaller iPad. And I just kind of wanted to touch on that again for a second. And I think there is, I'll just speak for myself, like it is always frustrating if you make a purchase and, you know, something comes along a little bit later that is newer, shinier, right? The nerd in all of us gets upset about that. But I think it's just particularly weird this time that they're so close together and that Apple is basically selling these as a larger and smaller version of the same thing. And, you know, whatever reasons that exist for these two devices being a little bit different, and we went over some of those possible reasons last week, it's just always sort of an uncomfortable position to be in. I, for one, am not, like, super upset about it. I understand it's the way it works. It would be nice to have those things, but I figure my next 12.9-inch iPad will have those things. And so it's not keeping me up at night. What about you?
I mean, yeah, it is. I would say it is strange when you just bought a new device and then like 5 months later, a new version comes out and it's got a bunch of features that you don't have. But I'm not really upset personally because the features that are on the new 9.7-inch iPad Pro, I don't really care about. You know, I don't take pictures with my iPad except, you know, the occasional selfie. I don't particularly care about the True Tone display. I mean, of course, if the next bigger iPad Pro has a True Tone display, I'm going to be happy. But it's just I'm not really upset right now. And I feel like my initial judgment, you know, of the day of the event when I said the iPad Pro has, you know, things like more RAM, faster charging, those are the things I care about. So it is strange that a new iPad has these new features, but it also makes sense, you know, it's coming out later. Maybe they weren't ready. Maybe they only make sense for a more portable iPad, but I'm not really upset right now. I'm still super, super happy with my 12.9-inch iPad Pro. So, yeah.
Yeah, me too. I spent some time, we have an Air 2 in the house, and I spent some time with it over the weekend just to sort of clarify my thoughts on the two different sizes. And no doubt using the 12.9-inch makes the 9.7 feel smaller, right? Like the same way you use a 6S or 6S Plus, and then you go back to something like, you know, that 4-inch size, and everything just feels cramped and small. But for me, really, the kicker continues to be the multitasking, where you can have a lot bigger view into apps on the larger iPad, which I think is really, like I said last week, I think it really has a sort of unlocked something about the way that I treat iOS.
Yeah, you know, I went through this when I was reviewing the iPad Pro last year. Split view, going back to the iPad R2, trying to use split view on the smaller iPad and the bigger iPad, there's really no contest for me. I generally appreciate split view more on the bigger iPad Pro, not because it's more comfortable. Well, I mean, also because of that, but just because you see more, you know, you see more content, you see more text when I'm writing, I see bigger lists, you know, so it's a matter of comfort, like physical comfort of viewing two apps at the same time, but also content, more content shown at once. And for me, that's more important than, you know, a better camera or a True Tone display.
Yeah, it's something to, like to consider, I think, especially if you're looking to do work on iOS. Something too I want to touch on was the LTE thing. You know, in the with the big iPad Pro, LTE is only available on the biggest model, the most expensive model, which is the one I got because I wanted LTE. But on the 9.7 inch, it's available at all sizes, like it's been historically. And I just wonder, you know, sometimes Apple does these sort of things, and it's a bit of a statement, right? That this is the way we want you to use it. And I wonder if the statement here is the 12.9 inch is sort of for like working at a desk in an office, and the 9.7 inch is portable where you may need LTE more. Does that ring a bell with you?
It does, and I feel like Apple wants to sort of leave this message out in the world right now that, you know, the smaller iPad is meant for like portable scenarios, like you're walking around, you want to hold the iPad with one hand, whereas the iPad Pro, you know, the 12.9 inch is more of an office-like iPad. And again, it depends on, you know, many variables, like how do you use your iPad or how big are your hands? Because I can walk around holding my big iPad Pro with no problem, but it sort of makes sense for Apple to have this kind of message. You know, we have some new features, but we don't really want to tell you that they're not available on the bigger iPad Pro because, you know, we want to make money in some different way with the smaller iPad Pro, or because they weren't ready. We want you to believe that it's because, you know, this makes sense on a portable device. That's marketing, you know, and that's okay. But I feel like people who are in the market for an iPad, and according to Apple, that's people coming from a PC. If you look at the iPad Pro webpage, they don't really tell you, we want you to stop using a Mac. They're just, you know, sort of pushing the iPad Pro to PC people. And it makes sense to come up with these marketing strategies. But again, you know, I work better, I feel like, on the bigger iPad Pro.
Yep, totally the same thing here. So, of course, the other device announced was the iPhone SE. We spoke about it at length last week, and really in the weeks leading up to this, that at least in my household, an iPhone SE was going to be ordered, and it has been ordered. One thing I think we sort of skipped over a little bit in our discussion last week was the price. So I generally buy iPhones, like the SIM-free version. Basically, it's unlocked, you bring your own SIM card. And the SE added the 64-gigabyte model for my wife, and it was $499. And for someone who has bought high-end iPhones unlocked for a long time, it really seemed like I double-checked that I was buying the unlocked version. If you're still in a two-year contract, even though I know that is fading away in the States, this is now the free phone. And if you buy it unlocked, it starts at $399, where the 6S starts at $649. And that just sort of brings up those memories of the iPhone 5C, right? That people thought the 5C was going to be the cheap phone. In reality, it was just a repackaged iPhone 5. And didn't really move in the volume that Apple had planned or wanted it to. And I just wonder if the SE is part of the SE is a crack at that again to see, can we put a good phone at a lower price point? And really, you know, the SE at $399 is better than the iPhone 6, which is in the middle price slot in a lot of ways. But, you know, I think the 5C sort of failed for a couple of reasons. Maybe people realized that it was old tech and they didn't want that, and that it looked, you could look at it and tell it was cheap. And the worst thing you could say about the SE is that you look at it and think that maybe it was old. And I just wonder if people see that as a distinction, that you know, if you had a bright yellow plastic 5C, it kind of screamed that you bought, you know, the cheaper phone. And maybe if you see an SE, it's, oh, you bought the expensive one, but years ago. Like, I wonder if people think that. But either way, I think it's going to be interesting to see what the iPhone SE does sales-wise because of that price point. Is that going to bring new people to the iPhone? Is it going to, obviously, it's going to take their average selling price down a little bit, I think. But I can't help but think that the SE is like another stab at making the iPhone more affordable for more people.
It seems to me like it's a better executed strategy than the 5C. You know, not just because of the design, that it looks more sort of evergreen, like a classic design from Apple that a lot of people prefer in terms of industrial design to the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6s, but also because of the you know, how it's marketed to people. It's modern technology with the exception of 3D touch. So it's really the latest iPhone in a more compact package at a much cheaper price. And it looks to me like they have learned from the iPhone 5C. And even the name, you know, it rings more classic. It's like an iPhone special edition. It's more, I have the impression that it's going to last more, you know, than the iPhone 5C, which was like a weird spin-off on the iPhone 5. And it looked kind of toyish, you know, with the colors. And I do see a lot of iPhone 5Cs out in the world. I don't have numbers. We don't have numbers about the iPhone 5C. But I feel like the iPhone SE, it's an overall better take on having a cheaper iPhone with new technology, with, you know, the current camera, the current LTE technology, Touch ID, no 3D touch, but, you know, for a lot of people, that's not going to be a big deal. I feel like, and this is totally my the opinion of a non-analyst for sure, but it looks like a better strategy going forward.
Yeah, I think so too. I wonder if, like, how that time frame is going to roll out. Like, I don't think this is going to be something that is updated every year. You know, is this going to be something that it's current now, but by the time a refresh comes around, it's going to be old? Or is even, they talked about this on the talk show a little bit this week, is this even like a one-off? And is it to sort of bridge the gap until people are really okay with bigger phones? Like, it's just unknown, right? This is new territory for the iPhone line. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. You know, I know that that my wife's excited to get it. I know a lot of people are, and I think it'll do well. But I guess we'll just have to see what they do over the long term with it to kind of see what lessons are to be learned.
Yeah.
So up next, talking about the Apple Watch, the new nylon band. Mm-hmm. And so I picked one up this weekend. The Memphis Apple Store actually just reopened. They had a big renovation, kind of first of its kind here in the States. But so I wanted to go check that out. And then I ended up picking up one of the nylon watch bands, and I picked up the black and gray one. And I know other people have said this, but they really do look better in person than on the website. On the website, they look like sort of uncanny valleys and somehow, but
they looked kind of ugly to me. Then I went to check them out in a store, and they're, you know, some colors are actually quite nice.
Yeah, you know, the colors necessarily aren't my personal taste, but I think that they are going to prove to be popular. But I gotta say, it is an extremely comfortable watch band. The you know, the sport band, which I like and own several of, and I have been wearing my Apple Watch a little bit again recently. We could talk about that at some point, but this breathes much better than the sport band. So like yesterday, I mowed the grass and some yard work, and normally, like, the inside of my sport band and the inside of my watch would just be really wet from, like, being sweaty. And the nylon band does a much better job at sort of, I guess, it is absorbing part of that. So I guess that's kind of gross. But it's, like, much cooler to wear, if that makes sense. And so far, I'm a big fan of it. It's well done. It, you know, it definitely is not, like, the NATO style, like was rumored. It is just a nylon watch band. But so far, two thumbs up for me.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get one for the summer. It looks like a summer band to me, you know?
Yeah.
I think I'm going to get one.
So, you know, and I like that they're doing new stuff here. You know, they've pretty consistently every 6 months or so, they've had new colors and new options. And I think that's going to be a big part of their strategy moving forward to help keep the thing fresh in between big product cycle release type things.
I wonder if there's someone as crazy as you who's going to collect all of the Apple Watch bands. There has to be someone.
It's Mike.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Sometimes I have that thought of, like, I even have like a, I need to pick it back up. I used to have a series on 512 of like things that I would bet would become collectible in the future. And the best part of that as a topic is no one can prove me wrong for like 10 years. But sometimes I think about that, like I kind of wish that I had kept my first iPhone and I didn't. For a long time, I needed to sell it to bankroll the next one. And so now I'm just now kind of like, maybe I should pick up an iPhone, you know, like the original 2G iPhone. But I don't know if watch bands are going to be one of those things or not, honestly. My guess is probably not. But you're talking to somebody who owns every color of iPod sock, so what do I know?
Never say never, Steven.
That's right. So Federico, what's going on with the FBI?
Well, last night, the FBI officially dropped their case against Apple, you know, in the San Bernardino shooting with the iPhone belonging to a terrorist. Apparently, the FBI managed to unlock the iPhone. They were requiring Apple's assistance to unlock the phone. Now the phone has been unlocked. We don't know how. So the FBI didn't provide any details as to whether, you know, just what kind of tool a third party apparently, you know, gave the FBI to access the contents of the iPhone. They just, you know, they agreed to vacate the order again, you know, against Apple to. They were requiring Apple to help the FBI in assisting, you know, in this iPhone unlock process. Now the case is gone for now, so it is over, you know, quote unquote over. Because the general feeling is that sooner or later there's going to be another case and the FBI is going to try again to compel Apple to, you know, create a version of iOS with a backdoor, essentially, that would allow the FBI to bypass the four-digit passcode, just any passcode check that iOS has in place to prevent people from getting into a locked iPhone. So we don't know what's going to happen in the future. For now, this specific case has been dropped, so you could ascribe that as a win for Apple, but it's not really a win for Apple. It's just maybe a pause in a debate that's going to continue in the next few years, I guess.
Yeah, I have the same feeling you do that this particular case is over, but this is not over, right? That I think now that this door has been opened, the possibility to try to go after Apple or other companies, right? This doesn't just have to be Apple. That this sort of door can't be closed, and that at some point something terrible is going to happen, and this is going to come back up. I mean, there's a lot of like debate over what really happened, right? So, like, did the FBI really unlock it? They said in court they did, so I'll take them at their word that they did. I assume that they either did it, you know, through something the NSA had, or maybe they said, you know, we're going to go ahead and brute force it and just risk, I guess, that the delete files after 10 attempts is turned off. I don't really know. They're obviously not going to be real forthcoming with that. But while it is a victory today, it sort of feels like, well, that's like the first battle, but there's still a war coming over encryption. And, you know, Apple from the beginning has said this should be decided by the people. This should be not done in the court, right? Should go through the lawmaking process, that there should be a law that talks about this, because the law that was used in this case is ancient and very vague in a lot of areas. And because there is no legislation here in the United States that really deals with this in a proper modern way. And so I wonder if that's how we're going to see this unfold next, that someone is going to introduce legislation either for or against Apple's stance. And, so yeah, so I don't think this whole idea of like the government getting into encrypted phones is over quite yet, but it's over for now, I guess. And I guess we'll see kind of where that goes. But you know, you got to think that I hesitate to say this, but I think the FBI did a pretty good job at picking a case to bring this up, right? Like a lot of people in this country and around the world are willing to do things and make decisions based on terrorism that they wouldn't maybe otherwise. And that clearly is what the FBI was betting on, right? Like what happened in San Bernardino was heartbreaking. And I think they were trying to capitalize that. It's kind of too strongly worded, but they were trying to use that, right? They're not going to choose like a bank getting robbed or someone's getting mugged to unlock an iPhone, right? They're going to do something big. And they did, and it didn't work. So it's just going to be curious to see where this goes. And I guess time will tell, like all things. But I'm not comfortable that the government's not going to ask for this again. Know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot, and it's not that I don't understand the position of the government or, you know, law enforcement, because when something as terrible as, you know, the San Bernardino shooting happens, I do understand that you, as law enforcement, you want to be able to have measures to monitor bad people. You know, it makes sense that you want to be able to keep an eye on criminals. And living in Italy, I see this on the news, sadly, very often. You know, we have the problem with many types of the mafia in Italy. And you, when you turn on the news, you very regularly you hear about, you know, law enforcement managing to capture a mafia boss. Also because they were able to plant cameras or they were able to plant microphones inside the, you know, the home of a boss or, you know, the home of a group of people related to a mafia association. And so I do understand why monitoring the bad guys is beneficial for the public. But it's quite different. I've been thinking about it. It's quite different to be able to say we're going to break into a home and we're going to plant microphones, we're going to plant cameras because we know that this person is a criminal and we want to keep an eye on them and we want to catch them in the act or we want to collect proof. It's quite different from doing that and having access to a device that is used by bad guys, but that is also used by the majority of good people around the world. So the main problem is we live in a different era. You know, we live in an era where our most private and personal information is not confined in the walls of our houses, but it's stored on a chip in a small device that we carry around all the time. And so the ways that the government and the law enforcement thinks about monitoring the bad guys are gonna change. Have already changed, and I do understand to an extent the struggle of law enforcement and the government to say, why do these criminals use these devices to communicate, and why are we not able to monitor them? And the sad, and maybe just the reality, is that the world has changed, and the way we communicate has changed, and I feel like it's a very dangerous precedent to be able to, especially after we saw what, you know, Snowden revealed about the NSA in the US, it's very dangerous to be able to say we want to create essentially a weapon that would enable us to monitor everyone. Mm-hmm. So it's the main problem is it's a different world for people, for criminals, for government, for law enforcement agencies. It's a different world. I don't know how this is going to play out, but I do know that at the very basic level, at least personally, so this is my belief, is that people have a right to privacy, people have a right to digital security. And bypassing that, even if you say it's only for good intentions, but to create a tool that would, you know, bypass that personal privacy, it's gonna be messy because it's gonna end up in the wrong hands. So, you know, it's a very difficult problem to discuss. But I'm sort of glad that we're having this discussion because I feel like, setting aside this case, if Apple and the FBI and the US government and, you know, other agencies in Europe and around the world, if they can sit down, you know, at a table and discuss what do we want to do here, I feel like, as you know, human beings, good people can find the solution. Maybe I'm too optimistic. I don't know.
No, I think it is important because so many things in this era of political, you know, the political climate, and America's been at war on terror for so long that so many things get decided privately and behind closed doors, where the public can't see into them, right? And so for Apple and the FBI to do this publicly, like, that was a choice on the FBI's part, right? There could have been gag orders, or there could have been things put in place to keep this quiet, and the FBI decided to make it public, I think in hopes to swing public opinion and that sort of thing. But it's important that it's in public because it does affect every single one of us, right? If our phones are not secure and our phones have pictures of our family and our private emails and, you know, corporate secrets and bank account information and health information, right? Like, all this stuff is on these devices. then everyone has the right to know whether the government or any other party can get into those. And so while I disagree with the government's stance on this, I do have to say at least it was in public this time. And that's a nice change compared to some of these other things that, that people have been put through over the years. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, we're going to move on. But first, we'll take a quick break and tell you about our first sponsor this week, which is our awesome friends over at Smile. Now, Smile is the maker of a bunch of great Mac and iOS apps, but today we're going to talk about PDF Pen Pro, the all-purpose PDF editing tool. You've heard us say that PDF Pen is the Swiss Army knife for PDFs. Well, PDF Pen Pro is the knife with so many tools it can barely fit in your pocket. It has everything you need. With PDF Pen Pro, you can add signatures, edit text and images, perform OCR on scanned documents, and even export into Microsoft Word format. We all have those people in our lives who just need office documents, and PDF Pen Pro can help you create them. But only with PDF Pen Pro can you create interactive PDF forms, build tables of content, set document permissions, and convert websites to multi-page PDFs. PDF Pen Pro 7 also allows you to export, like I said, to Microsoft Word, but also Excel, PowerPoint, and PDF archive formats. You can even add tooltips to your PDFs for voiceover accessibility, and this list of features just goes on and on. This is a really powerful piece of software. You know, I deal with PDFs a lot at work. We have contracts with our sponsors. We have documents with our hosts and attorneys and accountants. Lots of PDFs come across my desk every day. And I use PDF Pen Pro to deal with them and to sign stuff and to edit things and mark things up and send it back to people. And it really is great. You can try a free demo of PDF Pen Pro 7 today by visiting smilesoftware.com/connected. PDF Pen Pro 7 requires Yosemite or later and works great on OS 10 El Capitan. Thank you so much to Smile for sponsoring this show and all of Relay FM. So, our friend Mike, who is, like we said, is off this week, has been Sherlocked.
Oh, okay. Is that why you flew to Romania?
Yes, he needed to escape the Sherlocking. So, this really interesting article is came out in the New York Times a couple days ago, right? It's by Emily Steele, and it's one of those things where, like, this is new Apple, but it's still sort of a little weird, right? Where Apple announced that they're going to work with Will.i.am, of all mm-hmm. people, and a couple TV executives on a new show that spotlights the app economy.
Okay.
Basically, it's behind the app, but for TV, and there's, like, quotes from Eddie Q. Like, this is a very strange article, right? It's a very strange time to be...
I mean, the idea of having a TV show about developers is both kind of awesome and scary at the same time, because I wonder how that's going to be like. So the idea is that Apple is working with Will.i.am and these two TV executives to put together a TV series about the App Store, about apps, and I assume about, you know, app makers. We don't know any more details about this. It's going to be on iTunes. This is going to be on the App Store as, like, videos that you can watch on the App Store. Is this going to be on the web or YouTube? We don't know. But it is sort of interesting to me, if only for one reason. And that reason is, we've talked about this in the past. A lot of people, millions of people, I would say, they believe that all the apps that they download from the App Store come from Apple, or maybe they come from people who work for Apple. And I see this all the time, because whenever I say that I have a blog about, you know, Apple news, people tend to assume that I'm on Apple's payroll, you know, that sort of it's a blog by Apple. Mm-hmm. And I see the same assumption for apps and games. You know, it's on the App Store, so these people are paid by Apple, and then you have to, you know, download stuff from the App Store either for free or by paying Apple. A lot of people have no idea about the whole developer community, what WWDC is or means, what it means to be an iOS developer or a, you know, Mac developer. That's the joke on the Mac App Store. I feel like it sort of makes sense to explain to Apple customers that the whole app economy is made by people who are not living in Cupertino, you know, or don't work for Apple. But my concern is this going to be one of those, you know, like a couple of episodes about high-profile developers like the folks at Adobe, at Microsoft, and, you know, is this going to be an indie type of show? You know, like, what's the name of the documentary that it's being worked on? App the Human Story?
Yes.
This is going to be that kind of stuff, you know, that they look at the actual independent developers, you know, the individuals who design apps, who make apps, or is this going to be like a couple of high-profile studios, you know, EA or, you know, King with Candy Crush. We don't know. It's probably going to be a little bit of both, hopefully.
Yeah, I have all of those same questions. And the big question for me is that, like, if Apple's going to be tinkering with content, then why not make something with broader appeal? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I'm sure that all of us are going to check this out and, you know, if it's terrible, not get very far into it. But like, I just think about people who like carry iPhones, like, are they going to be like interested in this? Or is Apple saying, hey, you know, maybe this won't be a super broad appeal type show, and so we can really experiment with like creating content, right? Like maybe they pick something that would be less popular than say something like a superhero show, so they can kind of work the kinks out. Like I can see both sides of that. But it just seems like such an odd way to get started. And there's this quote by Eddie Q in here saying, this doesn't mean that we're getting into a huge amount of movie production or TV production or anything like that. And that the company would continue to explore exclusive projects similar to the series about apps or its push into music programming. So, you know, this, you've got the Dr. Dre thing that's also kind of been talked about. Like maybe they see this as more or less like a marketing push. Like maybe it's not about creating TV, but it's about creating like marketing content to explain the App Store and explain why their products mm-hmm. are best as the platform owner. Does that make sense?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's not going to be a show, you know, about developers dealing with provisioning profiles in Xcode. I think that's for sure. I mean, I would watch that, especially if it's like a thriller or a drama, you know, like House of Cards meets Xcode. That would be awesome. But I don't think it's going to be that. And, you know, especially when you consider what Apple is doing with Apple Music, they're also working on a documentary series with Vice on the, you know, the local music scenes. So Apple is doing a bit of these sort of series about showcasing what goes on in the world of Apple services and Apple devices. So I don't feel like it's going to be a show about Lauren Richter creating Pull to Refresh, you know?
Right.
That would be awesome.
I'd watch it.
Yes, me too. But, you know, sadly, I think it's going to be... Sadly, I mean, maybe for my geeky perspective, but it's probably for the best, you know, if it's a broader appeal that, you know, even my mother can understand. I feel like it's gonna do a favor to everyone if more people can understand what it means to make an app. That's the message, judging from this article from the Times, which is, you know, doesn't have a lot of details, but the idea is it's gonna be a TV production for the general audience to understand what it means to create apps and to sell apps on the App Store. That's probably a good thing, but I feel like a lot of nerds are gonna say, yeah, you know, this is like pop stuff, and we, you know, there's especially with all the technical problems with the developer community, I can imagine, you know, months from now, a lot of developers saying, yeah, Apple is making the big TV show about big apps and big games on the App Store, but, you know, where's Test Flight for the Mac App Store? I feel like that's going to be the general reaction on tech blogs. We'll see.
I mean, that's what I would write. So, I mean, I see what you're saying about that. And I do think there's something interesting there of sort of explaining like who developers are. But I can kind of like see this picture playing in my mind. They're interviewing somebody and like, they start ranting about like sales charts or the race to the bottom. And they're like, no, cut, you know, and like, you know, like how... how honest of a picture can this be if Apple's putting it together, right? Because you do have these voices in the community that kind of call the App Store out for its issues and its problems. And is Apple going to paint everything as like a rosy, like, worldview, like this gold rush mentality, when really that's not what the App Store is anymore, right? The App Store has become highly competitive and full of garbage, quite honestly. And a lot of developers are struggling to find their place and make a living there. And so you can see this, like, this kind of going a couple of ways. Like, if it is this like marketing push, like being really like a romanticized version of app development, right? You have your idea, development goes really smoothly, you have no competition, you launch it, you make tons of money, and that's great. Well, in reality, a lot of apps aren't very good, don't get popular, right? Developers probably don't make their money back that they have in it in a lot of cases, and they sort of move on, right? Like even the two of us, like, we're in a weird situation because we know all the successful people, right? But for every successful app on our home screen, there are thousands of apps that have 12 downloads, and that's it. So I just kind of wonder where this will land on that continuum of what the App Store is kind of actually like for a lot of people. That got dark. Sorry. Something to think about, right? I mean,
yeah.
Anyways, so that's a thing, right? Like, do you see, I mean, can you imagine a world where Apple is making, like, say something like what Netflix is doing, right? Like, I just finished second season of Daredevil. Like, I've watched a lot of Netflix shows that they've created. I watched a lot of Amazon Prime shows they've created. Obviously, Top Gear crew is doing a big Amazon Prime show later this year. Like, do you see Apple moving into that space at some point?
I don't know. I guess that it would make sense. You know, they've been working with artists to make video clips for Apple Music. Now they're doing this kind of TV series. I do see that happening. It's just kind of odd to imagine right now. I don't know if Apple can do what Netflix is doing. You know, we had a lot of actual TV shows with multi-million dollar productions going on at once. I don't know if I want to think of Apple as a content company anymore that I think of Apple as a services company or a product company. I guess it makes sense. It's just strange to think about.
It is strange to think about, but like, it was strange when Apple started selling music, right? Like, yeah, it was strange when the computer company started making a phone. Like, I just want, what I'm getting at, like, I wonder if this is like the natural evolution of technology companies to still be technology companies, but to have a content division. I just don't know. Like, it is, I agree with you, it's strange, but I also wonder if it's also somehow inevitable.
Yeah, probably.
Anyways, something to think about. So we're going to get to iOS 9.3 woes. they seem to be a few issues going on there. Uh-huh. But first, we're going to take our second break and talk about Ministry of Supply. Everyday clothing should be smarter by now. It should be designed for the needs of a body in motion, not a static mannequin. We are all on the go all day, and our clothing should adapt with us. Because the only way we can truly feel comfortable is if our clothes are designed to work with our bodies instead of against them. That's the vision that drives Ministry of Supply, a performance professional menswear company that launched out of MIT 4 years ago. I just love it. It's so cool. They make polished business clothes that are engineered by MIT-trained engineers to provide technical benefits like body temperature regulation, sweat-wicking fibers to keep you dry, and stretchable fabric to allow you to move more freely. Now, Ministry of Supply, their most tech-forward dress shirt, the Apollo, I love that's a space name, and even their shirts have nerdy names, they're made with a lot of really cutting-edge stuff, like moisture-wicking fibers that are infused with NASA-developed temperature-regulating phase-change material. This is what astronauts use to stay cool in space. They feature a light-knit construction for breathability and a four-way stretch for mobility. Ministry of Supply even commissioned a research study by a university in Portugal that found it was 15 times more breathable than a standard off-the-shelf 100% cotton dress shirt. All of their clothes are easy to maintain and wrinkle resistant. You can wash and dry them at home, and there's no need to iron, which if you're like me, is a huge win. Now, I've got a couple of Mini Supply shirts, and they're simply great. I don't have to wear a dress shirt very often anymore, but when I do, it's my first couple that I go to because they always look good. I don't have to worry about ironing them, like I said. They're just ready to go, and they look great. They fit really well, and I'm comfortable in them regardless of the temperature outside. So you can find out more and shop online at ministryofsupply.com/connected. And if you use the code connected, you'll get 15% off your first purchase and show your support for our show. And what's really cool, this is like my favorite thing. If you want to shop in person at a Ministry of Supply store, like actually go into a brick and mortar store, and you mention our podcast, you'll get 15% off your first purchase. And again, that code is connected. It works in the real world as well. So thank you so much to Ministry of Supply for supporting this show and all of Relay FM.
So there's an odd problem going on with a bunch of odd problems.
As I say, just one?
Actually, a couple. Going on with iOS 9.3. One that's been apparently fixed. The other, it's kind of weird. So let's start with the one that's been fixed. Steven, you're the expert on all devices. Can you tell me what's going on with all devices running iOS 9.3?
Yeah, so there's some sort of weird activation bug.
Yeah.
And it seems to be dealing with, like, not only, like, super old, like, iPad 2s, but also, like, the iPad Air and the iPhone 5S. It seems like there's muddied waters here, but basically, you run an update, and the device won't reactivate, which is problematic, because then it's just sitting there, right? And so this is really kind of like two issues in one. We got some links in the show notes. You can go read about it. Apple has released an updated build of iOS 9 to deal with this. So if you have a device stuck in activation lock, you can plug into iTunes and run updates and it should be okay. But it's definitely concerning, right? Like there's always this thought in the back of my mind with old iOS devices like... you know, how does the new software run on them? And in this case, it doesn't run at all. So I guess they really swung for the fences there.
I feel bad every time one of these problems pops up because every time my friends ask about, you know, should I update to the latest iOS versions? I'm like, yeah, sure, you should go ahead because it fixes bugs and it, you know, adds features and it's more stable. But every once in a while, my friends come back to me and they're like, well, thank you for that. Now I'm having all sorts of crazy problems. And every time I'm like, yeah, I know, I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't know what to do, you know?
Yeah, and it seems like you know part of this is with like a signing issue with the 9.3 update. Doesn't seem like there's a ton known about this particular issue, but yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I don't even like run a backup before installing a point build of iOS. Right, like I trust the iCloud backup is fresh, and I don't think I've ever had a problem. I mean, it really has been really smooth sailing until now, and. You know, so I think this may unfortunately kind of put a bad taste in some people's mouth, especially right if your iPad 2 is locked out of use. But they seem to have gotten it fixed, unlike the other issue, which I think you're going to talk about.
The other issue is a problem with tapping links on iOS 9.3 with Safari, Mail, and also other apps. So this started last week. I started seeing these tweets from people asking me, are you seeing this odd behavior with Safari that you're unable to tap links and that Safari just hangs and it crashes? And I wasn't seeing the problem. And then I began seeing more and more people reporting this problem. And it sort of caught fire a couple of days ago when a lot of blogs started, over the weekend really, started to cover this issue. So in iOS 9.3, some users are affected by a problem in which after a while, just out of the blue, tapping links in Safari, Apple Mail, other apps as well, renders everything not responsive. So you tap a link, doesn't open. The browser just hangs and it stops working and it crashes. A reboot doesn't fix the problem. Uninstalling apps doesn't fix the problem. So a lot of developers and smart folks have done some, digging into this issue. And it seems to be related to universal links. So universal links is a feature introduced with iOS 9 that allows a traditional link to a domain, such as, let's say apple.com, to open in the native app instead of Safari. And it seems like some apps, such as the booking.com app, and 9to5Mac has a list of other apps, some apps that implement universal links are causing this issue for one specific reason. Universal links are based on this payload, on this file that contains the list of domains that should redirect to the native app. And some apps with a very huge payload, so with this huge file, like a couple of megabytes, it should be a couple of kilobytes, really. But apps that have a big, association file with this list of domains that goes over, a couple of megabytes, causes the problem for Safari and other apps. When you tap links, you should go to the universal link in the native app, but actually you're just hanging the system and it, rebooting doesn't fix it. And a lot of users are it's a problem because, tapping links is one of the most obvious features on any device. So I saw that there's a tutorial going around and it's like a crazy series of steps that you need to follow to kind of fix the problem. You need to use iTunes, you need to put your device in airplane mode, you need to uninstall, reinstall the app. There's a link in the show notes for those who are affected by the problem, kind of want to try their hand at this solution, which apparently is working because I saw quite a few people saying that it's a crazy workaround, but it's working. Also, 9to5Mac is saying that they is reporting this comment from an Apple spokesperson saying that they're aware of the issue and they're working on a fix. It's not clear if it actually came from Apple PR or from Apple support on Twitter, but word on the street, as the kids say, is that Apple is working on a fix, and I assume there's going to be an iOS update. I also saw, quite amusingly, a few Safari engineers on Twitter pointing people without actually commenting on the bug itself, but just, saying, well, go to the, instead of putting hundreds of domain names in the for universal links, use wildcards to avoid duplication of domains. So it seems like it's a universal link problem, and I would be surprised if Apple is now working on iOS 9.3.1 at this point. It's a kind of nasty bug,
So let me see if I've got this straight. So an app basically has a file on disk, yes. Right? That
on the server.
Okay, on the server that basically keeps record of the URLs that it watches, yes. For. And if those URLs, yep. Are hit, it sends you back to the app.
Yes. Right?
So the issue seems to be, at least with this bookings.com, which has been in a lot of these examples, mm-hmm. that file is like crazy big.
Huge, yes.
Right. So the wildcard would obviously be much less data to parse.
Efficient, yes.
And much more efficient. I mean, it really seems like, I want to talk about the beta program here in a second, but this in particular seems like sort of like a crazy bug that someone probably should have hit in the beta, but... It's one of those things, too, that's like, it's not completely within Apple's control, right, what third parties do. So bookings.com wants to write this, like, terrible... I forgot how... I saw, Stephen Trouton-Smith had a tweet about how big that file was. Third parties are going to third party, right? Like, they're going to do what they're going to do. So it's not completely within Apple's control, but at the same time, it's like Apple's going to get the blame, and they probably should have had safeguards in place that... If someone had a file like this or some sort of situation they're put in, like the OS should know how to handle it better. Right.
Yeah, so. And it's not even iOS 9.3 only. I think I saw some people saying it also happens on iOS 9.2, iOS 9.1. So it's really a problem with universal links. It just popped up, right after the iOS 9.3 update. And I think it raises another question, Stephen. Should universal links, should deep linking be an option Should it be a setting? Because I know a lot of people don't like universal
I would
links.
I would turn it off.
See? and I feel like, you know, we've talked for years about the fact that Apple should provide a deep linking option on iOS, that Apple should allow users to choose different default apps for opening links, like I want to set Google Chrome as my default browser for HTTP and, you know, web links. And it raises a question, should this be an option at this point? Just make it a toggle in the setting and let users choose to enable universal links, to enable, you know, a different browser, a different mail application. Because whenever, you know, considering this bug, it's surprising that Apple didn't see it coming. It's also surprising that it wasn't caught in a beta, especially with the public beta. But it also makes me wonder if at this point it should be not a half-baked solution as universal links, given this problem, maybe, but a full-on option that encompasses not just, you know, universal links on Safari, but any kind of link, any kind of default app on iOS. With an option, you know, a lot of people would turn it off and, you know, they wouldn't have this problem, but also it would add complexity. So it's the usual trade-off, I guess.
Right. Yeah, and the trade-off is always going to exist in a situation like this. I think my feeling is that a lot of people are probably confused about the way that it works. Like, or I find it frustrating sometimes if I tap something and it opens in an app, and then I left that app in a certain state, right? And now that state has changed because I opened something in Tweetbot. Like, so for me, like, I don't find them as useful maybe as Apple thought that people would. And maybe that's just me. But I do agree with you that the beta process should have, that should have been discovered, right? Like, clearly this is not something new, right? These third parties have been using files like this chock full of URLs, and clearly Apple system, whatever is parsing those or respecting those rules, doesn't work, you know, right? Like, it crashes out. It's odd that this only came to light after 9.3 shipped. And so I would have said, oh, well, something must have changed, right, between the last beta and what they pushed out to the public. They tweaked something. And that may be true. It may not be true. I didn't look at the build numbers. But if old, you know, like you said, 9.1, 9.2 are seeing these issues as well, like, why is it just coming to light now? And, of course, there's always the sort of, like, copycat scenario, right? Like, only a few people see the bug, but you hear about it online, and then it sort of gets magnified, right? People kind of come out of the works like, oh yeah, I do have that. And, you know, I mean, how many people do we know who run into an issue with their device and just work around it, right? Like, how many people do we know who use Assistive Touch because their power buttons got smashed in, even though Apple had a repair extension program for it on the iPhone 5? Like, people just work around stuff. And so maybe this was out there. Maybe it was known by some people and they just sort of...
Now it's everywhere.
accepted, right? Maybe they just accepted that's how it was and they just, you know... Maybe people in the public beta, you know, they put that feedback app on your phone, but like, how many people are actually doing that? Like, I'd be very curious to know the number of people who are in the public beta versus the number of tickets they get through that feedback system. Like, forget Radar, right? Like, put Radar aside, right? People like you and I are going to use Radar. Developers are going to use Radar, but put that aside. People just running the public beta, just like, you know, above average users, maybe not even professional users, but they just want to see what's coming next, right? They download the public beta and like, oh, well, this will get fixed. And they don't, you know, they don't follow through with it.
Oh, yeah, I'm seeing right now in the chat room, Benjamin Mayo from 9to5Mac saying that the quote is from Apple PR. So there you go. Apple is working on a fix and is working with developers to fix this issue. I'm really surprised that it wasn't caught before. I wonder if maybe, you know, the people who test iOS 9 betas just don't use booking.com a lot. They don't need to make hotel reservations a lot.
Right.
It's quite strange.
And you got to think that there are other sites doing this, right? Like, I think there are examples particularly egregious, but there's got to be other stuff out there that does this. And you know, maybe, I mean, clearly what happened is Apple never tested for it, right? That Apple never fed a file this big into that system and so never saw it implode, right? Like, I really believe if Apple had seen this bug, they would have fixed it, right? Like, I don't think Apple's the sort of company that lets something this big go by. But at the same time, like, there is some sort of problem here that it wasn't tested. You know, we had an email several weeks ago from a listener about the QA process, and I find QA just endlessly fascinating. I did a good bit of it at my last job, and just the idea of like testing for like the path that a user is going to take, but then also testing for all the variables. And my guess is that no one thought this was a variable, right? Like, it wasn't tested for. It's still a problem. It still crashes the device. Like, this is something that clearly caught Apple by surprise. And again, like that comes back to that QA issue. Like, is this something that should have been tested for? Maybe it should have been. Maybe it's so odd that it didn't cross anyone's mind, and that's fine. Like, you know, no one is perfect. Software has bugs. But it just seems like a real doozy to land, not only after the longest iOS beta we've ever seen for a point update, but also like at the same time with that activation bug. It's like a 1-2 punch against what otherwise is a pretty solid iOS release.
Yeah, this link problem quite nicely encapsulates the trade-off that Apple, you know, encounters when they're starting to open up iOS a little bit more. You know, by extending iOS to be able to redirect any link to a native app, the solution that they created, well, now you have a problem that, you know, if a developer abuses it, if they create an association file with too many domains in the list, it's going to crash iOS. You can make the argument that Apple should have seen this coming, and I do, because, or at least put some limitations in place to say your file should not be bigger than X kilobytes.
Right.
But really, the basic point is, in any sort of extensibility feature, it's a balance of providing more value to users, so, you know, more communication between apps, fewer limitations, you know, when using an iPhone or iPad, but also if things go wrong, it's going to be a problem for the whole system. So by opening up, you know, links to behave this way, now you got a problem with any link tapped in Safari or Mail. So I guess this is the bigger picture is the sandboxing model, for example, the big deal that Apple makes of the way that extensions work on iOS, that a problem with an extension doesn't crash the entire system. Now, with universal links, this is the opposite, because a problem with an app is causing problems with Safari, is causing problems with any link in any app that uses this technology. And, you know, it's a nice reminder that for any extensibility feature, there's a you know, the other side of the coin, which is quite ugly.
I don't envy anyone's job to sit there and try to come up with all these parameters and all these angles into iOS that could cause problems, right? QA is hard. And, you know, maybe someone did think, hey, we should put a limit on this. But I'm sure that some of it was done in good faith, that someone who is running a site as big as bookings.com or, you know, these others, like, would know better than to do their file the way they did it. And so whatever happened, I mean, Apple's clearly going to get it fixed. I agree with you. I think 9.3.1 is probably imminent. And you know, the world will move on. It's not the first time iOS updates have had problems, but it does feel particularly rough this time around, having two of them back to back. But it's, you know, it kind of is what it is. And yeah. I'm glad that, like, I haven't seen any issues. I assume you haven't either. I think I would have heard about it. You've been good? No problems?
I've been good personally. Yeah, I saw Ben Thompson on Twitter having the problem with the links in Google search in Safari. I just want to say, let's pour one out for the booking.com person who got the call from Apple over the Easter weekend.
Yeah. I'm sure that was...
That was fun, I guess.
Probably not the adjective I would use, but... so yeah, so hopefully next week we can talk about 9.3.1 being out and fixing these things. And you know... hopefully the beta program can kind of be more helpful in the future with these things. But I think it goes to like the types of users who do the beta program as well. Like, especially the activation issue. Like, I would imagine there's not a lot of people running the public beta on an iPad 2, right? Like, the people who run the public beta are the same types of people generally who are going to have the latest and greatest device, right? And so, you know, maybe there's some like weird vacuum there of users, and this was here all the time and they just didn't see it. Obviously there was a signing issue as well that may have caused problems, but I don't know. It feels like the beta program maybe didn't do what I think Apple wants it to do in this particular case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Federico, I think that does it for this week. Do you have anything else? Yeah.
No, you see, Mike goes away and iOS explodes. Mike, please don't ever go away again.
So if you want to find the show notes this week, a couple ways you can do that. You can check them out in the your podcast app of choice, which is streaming my voice to you right now. Or you can look at our website. This week, the URL is relay.fm/connected/84. You can get in touch with us there. There's a little email link in the sidebar. You can also find us on Twitter. The show is at @_connectedfm. You can find Mike, our fallen leader, at iMike, I-M-Y-K-E, on the Twitter. And you can find Federico at Vitici, V-I-T-I-C-C-I. And he, of course, writes the wonderful MacStories.net. You can find me on Twitter at ISMH and at 512pixels.net. And until next time, Federico, say goodbye.
Arrivederci.
Adios.